From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we have our weekly conversation with the editor-in-chief of ConsortiumNews.com, Joe Loria, who has just come from voting for the first time in Virginia. Tell us what that's like.
Well, Don, thanks for having me on back again this week. Oh, yes, it was pleasure. The first time. I just moved to Virginia earlier this year. I was not sure I was going to vote. A friend of mine kind of insisted, and then I discovered that the polling place was literally a block and a half away from where I'm living, so I had no excuse. So I walked over there. It took 5 minutes. And I just found a very, very sad environment there, and the whole thing was a sad exercise. They gave me a paper ballot, which is good. Of course, it's read by one of these scanners, but at least they have a paper to back it up, which I did not have in New York, at least last time I voted in New York, where I come from originally. I saw the ballot, and it said there, had only on the federal candidates did it show their party affiliations. On the backside were the local city council, board of education, things like that, and they did not show the party affiliations. Mm. So I asked the woman, and she explained that that's the way it is. So
statewide, is it? Is that the case in Virginia? Or because here in New York, some municipalities are like that. You know, in New York City, they have parties, for example, for mayor and all that. But in Briarcliff Manor, which is a village next to me in Westchester County, they have non-party elections. They don't have party lines for mayor and, you know, trustee and such. So
like that's school the case boards in Alexandria too. City. That could just be an Alexandria City.
That's what I was asking. Yeah.
Brule, which is where I live in Alexandria. Yeah. So I just don't know. But I'm used to, having voted in New York, I'm used to seeing the different party affiliations of local candidates like mayor and city council.
Yeah, right. From dog catcher to president, you know, or
now,
vice
the problem
versa.
For that, for me, was I've just moved here and I don't know anybody. I don't recognize any of the names. I confess I've not followed local government here at all. So they meant nothing to me, these names.
Right.
But when I looked at the federal, I noticed that there were only Democrats and Republicans for Senate, governor, I think, a few others. And I was a little bit surprised by that and depressed because I was determined not to vote for either major party. And not seeing any alternatives but Democrats and Republicans, I marked write-in and then I wrote none of the above. And so I didn't vote for anybody. There was, however, two referenda on the ballot, and typically they were very poorly written. I had to read them twice. And a woman sitting next to me, it was another new experience I had. I never sat down or stood in a booth and pulled levers in New York. This woman sitting next to me just said out loud in an exasperated way, "I don't understand this." Now, I realized I could not, I'm sure the rules were I couldn't lean over and try to help her. But I didn't see anybody of the election volunteers, workers there ready to explain what the referendum meant either. Maybe they're not allowed to do that. I don't know the rules on that. But I understand why she couldn't understand it, because I couldn't until I read it a couple of times. So the whole as I left this polling place, I couldn't avoid this feeling, Don, that I just participated in a farce, really. It was very sad.
I'm looking at a sample ballot for the city of Alexandria today.
Okay.
It's pretty thin. You've got the proposed constitutional amendment, question 1 and 2. Does this sound familiar? Should a county, city, or town be authorized to provide a partial tax exemption for real property that is subject to recurrent flooding if flooding resiliency improvements have been made on the property? Yes or no? Does that sound familiar?
That was the first one.
And then the second one, shall the real property tax exemption for a primary residence that is currently provided to surviving spouses of veterans who had a 100% service-connected permanent total disability be amended to allow the surviving spouse to move to a different primary residence and still claim the exemption? Yes or no? Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, if you have 20 minutes to ponder it, and if you get to do a little research, then you understand what those mean. To me, I understand them because that's my background is real estate and finance. But, they're confused. Otherwise, you got U.S. Senate, Corey Stewart and Timothy Kaine. Timothy Kaine being Hillary Clinton's running mate in 2016.
Right. No way I was voting for him, I can tell you that. And I don't know who the other guy was.
And he's a Republican. And then there's a Libertarian And then in the House, you have Thomas O. as the Republican and Donald Beyer Jr. as the Democrat.
There was a liberal on there, too. Do you see that?
That's a libertarian. That's
libertarian.
Matt J. Waters for Senate, yeah.
See, I don't know what L, I mean, maybe this is my fault, I guess, but I thought L meant Liberal Party, because in New York, we had a Liberal Party, too, if you remember.
Well, I'm actually assuming that. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I just wrote it. You're talking about Ray Harding, right?
It says L next to it. That's all it says is L. No, but, I thought that meant liberal, but maybe. But even if it was libertarian, I'm not voting for a libertarian either.
No, right.
Even
I know,
agree with
foreign,
on foreign policy with most of them, I don't agree on domestic at all. So
right.
There were no choices. That's what was depressing to me. It was there are no choices there. And the whole thing seemed – everybody was very sincere. All these volunteer workers, they were extremely pleasant. They really look like they believe in this system. That's what made me sad. Like it's like a farce.
Yeah,
but everybody's like led down to thinking that we've actually have choices in this country, and we don't. And this ballot really showed that to me, that there's no bloody choices. There's nobody on a Green Party or any other third party there. I'm used to in New York seeing Green Party candidates, socialists, workers get on the ballot sometimes.
Right.
You know, and there was nothing like that here. And that's, you know, really was made me quite depressed, to be honest with you. This is Election Day. Let's see what the results are going to be.
that might be more depressing, no matter which way it falls, by the way. And you know, one of the things that I think would disabuse people, you know, they assume that because there are elections that this is some sort of democratic process, but they really have very, you know, most people have very little understanding of the selection process. Like, okay, I get to choose between, you know, candidate A and candidate B, but who chose candidate A for that column, and who chose candidate B? If you try running for office, and then the people that come around that want to make a deal with you, like, well, we can put you on the ballot and we'll back you, but you have to do X, Y, and Z.
Yep.
If you refuse to do that and try to get on the ballot anyway, you will be disabused of the idea, the notion that there's anything democratic involved immediately. All
that
the way
works
through
the primaries
court
too.
And everything.
So
yep, that's
even
right.
In the primary, right?
Well, first you got to get on the ballot for the primary.
Right.
And the Board of Elections in New York, you have two commissioners at each county Board of Elections. One is a Republican and one is a Democrat. And what happens is you have to file a petition with signatures to get on the ballot, lots of signatures, thousands of signatures in most cases. And what happens is anyone who has standing to vote in that district has standing to challenge the petitions, and all they have to say is line one, signature one, no good, line two, signature one, no good, etc. And the Board of Elections now rules on each one of those things. And if they disallow enough signatures and you're below the threshold, you're off the ballot. Well, if I am not a Republican or a Democrat trying to get on the ballot, and some political hack challenges my petitions, and then the Republican commissioner and Democratic commissioner each say, no, that signature is no good, I'm off the ballot. I have 3 days from when they'd make a decision to bring a lawsuit in the state Supreme Court that's going to be heard and a determination made within days. And if that doesn't happen, if I don't have the resources for that, then fine. But what happens if the judges in New York, although they're elected, are also nominated by consent? There are only 7 candidates for the 7 slots in the state Supreme Court, for example. The political party chairs of the state parties decide who the candidates are going to be. So those are the guys who are going to be deciding on what the chairs of the local party did. And so they always side with the Board of Elections, almost always. So
the
it's rigged from the beginning.
Jobs. The guys who gave them the job, the ones who are going to decide. Yeah.
Right, so after all of that's over, now you go into the booth and the two people you're looking at were chosen by that process.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a farce.
Yep.
But, I mean, I knew that before, of course,
right,
going
of course,
in. But
yeah.
It really hit me in the face today. I mean, being there and seeing it and participating in this, that it was just like, God, I mean, it can't get worse than this.
Don't say that. They're working
maybe
on it.
Maybe to have no elections, wouldn't matter very much. Same people would just be appointed because they're being essentially appointed now, as you're saying.
That's right. Yep, at the head end instead of at the back end.
So what happened to you in New York when you voted?
Okay, so I live in the Village of Ossining in Westchester County. So we have a village board that has 5 members, a mayor and 4 trustees. Everybody's at large. In other words, the trustees, each of them represents the whole village. There's no districts or whatever. And it's a Democratic town. So, you know, if the Democrats ran a pumpkin or a jack-o'-lantern for office, the jack-o'-lantern would win. The Republicans wouldn't bother to oppose the pumpkin A, perhaps they couldn't find anyone sufficiently challenging, but B, the whoever they ran, even if they ran, you know, Malcolm X or Huey Newton or whatever, would lose to the pumpkin because the Democratic voters come out and pull the lever. By the way, in the next town over where it's Republican, it goes exactly the same way with the Republicans. This is the fundamental trait of American voters in local politics where they actually know the people involved. And maybe that's one of the reasons, who knows. But so I go in, we have in the village of Austin, we've had some real stresses with housing here. It's been one of the last communities gentrified in Westchester County, and it's been very aggressively gentrified the last few years. And in New York State, they did away with rent control back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and substituted for it a sort of a rent stabilization law that's called the Emergency Tenants Protection Act, or the ETPA, which requires a submission or a review to a local rent guidelines board every year of proposed increases in rents. And so if I'm a tenant and I live in Westchester County and the rent guideline board says the maximum rent increase this year is 4%, then my rent can only go up 4% if I'm in a qualified building. Austining did not opt into this law, so Austin has absolutely no protections for tenants whatsoever on that score. And about 3 weeks before the primary this year, the village board finally, I've been trying to do it since 2004, they finally adopted to opt in. They finally opted in and adopted the law. And the incumbent mayor, who's a Democrat, and one of the incumbent trustees, who's a Democrat, who's up for re-election, opposed the law. There was a mayoral candidate who primaried her and lost, who's in favor of the law and promises to reenact it if it gets knocked out in court because it was challenged by the landlords at the time it was passed. And they have a reasonable chance of setting it aside for some procedural mistakes, but that is whatever. So this whole election kind of hinges on the question of rent stabilization. And the political establishment saw to it that the Democrat, who is going to be the winner, is anti-ETPA. And so the Working Families Party is the only spot that the insurgent candidate who's in favor of this rent control, his name is Omar Herrera, that is going to appeared on the ballot today. I voted for him on that line. There was also a young man who was a trustee. About 2 weeks ago, somebody looked at his Facebook page, and he's in his early 20s. He had all kinds of, you know, misogynist, like almost like teenage nonsense about women and guys and all this kind of stuff there, which ended up in the newspaper. So he's kind of knocked out. Everybody walked away from him. Not to excuse it, but he's practically a child. He's very young. And the reason he did it, you know, he decided to run in the first place was because his family lives in this kind of housing, and he's trying to look out for the people that he knows. And instead, he's become an object of public scorn over it. Then we have Nita Lowey as a member of Congress. She's a Democrat. She ran the congressional campaign a few years back, and she was supposed to be in the U.S. Senate when Hillary Clinton came to New York. And took over the seat, I think it was Moynihan's seat that she took over in the year 2000, that was actually supposed to go to Lowey. And Lowey stepped out of the way for Hillary Clinton and was rewarded with all kinds of perks in the Congress. Well, she is one of the most anti-Palestinian members of Congress ever, not just at the moment, but ever. She's one of the most pro-war members of Congress, probably ever also, certainly over the last 20 years. And she was running unopposed, except for a young man who is running on the what's called the Reform Party. It's not the same as the Reform Party that Ross Perot founded, but something else that has ballot status in New York, way down the ballot. I would say he's probably lucky if he gets 10% of the vote. And then a bunch of judges, there were eight who were running for seven slots, okay? One of them, I don't know how he stumbled in there, but he's the only one I voted for. I bullet voted for him. And that's about it for what was on the ballot here. No propositions. Everything's right. Just fine as far as the propositions go. So I walked out of there, you know, feeling like, well, at least I got a chance to vote against Lowy, to vote for the ETPA, and to vote also Kirsten Gillibrand. I voted for her opponent just because she's been funding all these wars, and even if her opponent intends to, she hasn't yet.
And her opponent was a Republican?
Yes.
You voted for a Republican?
Yeah,
wow.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. Wow. If any incumbent Democrat in the Congress, if I were voting, I would vote for the insurgent Republican against them, with the exception of a Democrat whose, you know, position is warranted, you know, by their actions, by their career. If you know, Dennis Kucinich, Cynthia McKinney, if they were on the ballot, of course they're not. And you know,
banished.
But these other people, you know, warmongers. Hey, you already did your warmongering. I will not vote for you. I will vote for Satan before I'll vote for you.
A potential warmonger. Right. See,
Satan runs in 2 years, then I'll vote against it. Well, you know, I can't get myself to pull the lever for somebody that already has a body count.
Yeah, as much as I just opposed them established Democrats, I couldn't bring myself to vote for a Republican. So I wrote none of the above. Yeah,
so this is where we are. I mean, this is the situation that we face. It's difficult to call that a Democratic condition.
Yeah.
You know, it's which horrible choice do you want to make? That, you know, I can certainly condemn what I'm doing, you know, logically, you know, intellectually. I understand it. I understand that, you know, the attack to it. I didn't set the, you know, like Captain Kirk and the Kobayashi Maru, I didn't set the conditions of the test.
Speaking of democratic systems, let's move to Saudi Arabia.
Well, yeah, okay. I get your point. see how sharp we can be.
So
we've got this article. Yes. Let's start with the first piece, I guess. We are talking about the material, by the way, now at consortiumnews.com. And first is Marjorie Cohen's piece, right? Is that the one, despite the Saudi crisis?
No, the one above that, the one, the Saudi-U.S. crisis will pass, by Assad.
Abu Khalil. We'll start with Assad. Good, very good. Yeah, so, yeah, we've got it's Assad Abu Khalil, right? Yeah.
Yes, who, the angry Arab. We've talked about him before on the show. He's still angry.
Yep. Well, he still has cause, right?
I think he'll always be angry as far as I could tell. But he wrote a really incisive piece. It's basically what I thought all along, too. I'm sure other people did, but he fleshes it out, which is that all the hullabaloo about Khashoggi's murder and whether this is going to change the American Saudi alliance and friendship and blah, 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 is all rubbish. That it'll pass. It'll be papered over. It'll be forgotten somehow. It has had consequences like we've not seen maybe in a long time. And he goes to the history. For example, suddenly the New York Times last Sunday in its magazine section had like a 10,000-word piece on the war in Yemen. And they discovered it suddenly. So obviously the tens of thousands or 10,000 or more people who've been killed in Yemen and hundreds of thousands are in danger of starving to
millions,
death.
Millions, actually.
Because of this war that the Americans allowed the Saudis to prosecute. My theory is it happened during the negotiation over the Iran nuclear deal. And Obama, I think the Obama administration told the Saudis, look, go have your war and be distracted and shut the hell up, because they were screaming bloody murder, as the Israelis were, trying to get the Americans not to agree to this nuclear deal, which, of course, Trump has now obliged them by unsigning and pulling out of.
Right.
But at that time, I thought it was a good distraction. And I remember asking Jamal Ben Omar, who was at that time, he was an outgoing UN envoy to Yemen. He was the guy negotiating between the Houthis and the other parties to try to get a political deal after the Houthi had occupied Sana'a, the capital. And he agreed with that theory. He thought that's what happened. And he also told me something quite interesting, which was that he believed the Saudis started bombing because he was very close to a deal. They'd had agreement between the Houthi and all the other parties to have the Houthi withdraw from Sana'a their troops and have a UN-established force take over.
Wow.
The Houthi would get 20% of the parliament. Women would get 20% of the parliament. And that the only problem remaining was the presidency. Hadi, as you know, was the guy, the Saudi-backed president who had to leave and was
Well, his term was up. I mean, he was a compromise candidate at a previous basically a previous peace arrangement that had taken place like 4 years earlier or something. You had the legacy of the North and South of Yemen, and one, you know, was a U.S. ally, and the other was a Marxist-Leninist state. That's what it called itself. So right. There was, you know, some considerable cultural antipathy between the two. And Saudi Arabia, of course, being on one side and not the Marxist-Leninist side, obviously, being invested because it's contiguous. And then, so, and he, Hadi was supposed to be out, I think, in December of 2014 when his term was up. And there was supposed to be some successive processes for picking his, you know, his successor. And They were still feuding, like wrangling around the negotiating table. So he decided to stay on, and that was kind of the focal point. He wanted to make that permanent, and that was kind of the focal point of the breakdown that led to them being driven out of there, saying, look, you ain't president no more. Get out of here. And he, when he went to Riyadh, Riyadh said, oh, yes, he is, and tried to reimpose him.
Well, even given all that, the right. UN negotiator was, and the other parties, including the Houthi, according to Ben Ammar, were still going to allow him to have some role, but they wanted it to be a reduced one. In other words, he would have either a strong vice president that would come from another party to balance him, or there would be a rotating presidency like they used to have in former Yugoslavia. You know, every year or so, they would be the Serb or the Croat would be the – and the Saudis said no. They rejected that, but that hadn't been resolved yet. But they were close, and then they started bombing, and that was the end of the negotiation. I did a big scoop on that in the Wall Street Journal that was – at first denied by ambassadors going into Ben Ammar's last briefing at the Security Council in closed doors consultation. Uh-huh. But on the way out, they all said, yes, it was true that that's exactly what. So Ben Ammar had briefed me before he briefed the Security Council. and of course, the New York Times never, it was the big part of the article was how did this war begin? And they never referred to my story, of course. Right. But in any case, Assad goes in this piece into the two other instances where there was a major crisis in this relationship. That began in 1945 in that very famous meeting on a U.S. warship. As FDR was returning from the Yalta conference, he met with King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, who's the first Saudi king of the modern Saudi kingdom. And they made this deal where the U.S. would get a share of the oil revenues and part of the concession to pump the oil in Saudi Arabia. And Riyadh, in return, would be loyal to the U.S. and buy arms from the Americans. And the money would have to be some invested back into U.S. treasuries or in other ways. And the U.S. would give political cover to the Saudis so they can go on and do the barbaric things that they've always been doing, up until the murder of Khashoggi and the war in Yemen and other and backing of extremists and jihadists in Syria. And during the Cold War, as Assad points out, the Saudis spread extremist jihadi ideologies to counter the secular Arabs that were socialist in many ways that tilted towards Moscow. This the U.S. had to stop, and the Saudis were their proxies to do this up until Afghanistan, as we know, when they backed Osama bin Laden and other jihadists. So that, you know, the relationship withstood the first problem in 1973 of the oil crisis. People old enough to remember and who had cars had to stay on long lines to get gas in America because the Saudis embargoed oil to the U.S., jacking up the price and creating shortages. And that was over the 1973 Arab-Israeli war. So that, as Assad says, the Saudi regime couldn't really ignore the tide of Arab sentiment against U.S. intervention on Israel's side in that war. But he points out that at that time was King Faisal then, and he met with Kissinger, who was Nixon's Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, and the deal was that Israel would withdraw from the occupied territories in return for lifting the oil embargo. In the end, Faisal, as Assad argues, didn't really care about the Israeli occupation of Palestine. He was more, he was anti-Semitic, as Assad says, and he just didn't want to recognize Jewish religious rights in Jerusalem. He even made this remark that they could build a new wall where the Jews could weep. So ultimately, a new arms deal satisfied Faisal, and that ended the oil deal. Then in 1980, 7 years later, there was a crisis over a film, Death of a Princess. It was a British-made film based on a true story about the beheading of a Saudi prince who had the misfortune of falling in love with a commoner. Britain and the Saudis, through British government, and the oil lobby in the U.S., they put pressure on U.S. TV stations and British TV stations not to broadcast it, and very few did in the end, but that got papered over. And now we come to Khashoggi, and he's arguing that there's too much at stake here. and that the U.S. administration, the Trump administration, has most likely been working with the Saudis behind the scenes to come up with a cover story that could be believed and to end this crisis, and that it will eventually peter out, although the media has kept it going, the corporate media, because one of their, they consider, you know, a Washington Post writer was murdered, so now it's a big crisis, whereas right. tens of thousands of people die in Yemen, who gives a damn?
Right.
So this, I think it's a good piece, and it really goes into the history and wraps up why the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia will survive this crisis as it has previous ones.
Yeah, it's interesting because he comes to the conclusion, it, you know, I've been looking at Trump's posturing towards Iran, the threats and the reimposition of sanctions, which, you know, many of them had never been lifted. So it's bad. There are exemptions, but whatever. That is what it is. But I've been, you know, thinking in terms of what he did with Korea and, you know, with a suspicion that that's what's going on here, that he's playing hardball for the rubes at home, and he campaigned on this issue, so he's got to look like he's delivering. But by the same token, if he wants better relations with Russia and China, he can't have a war with Iran. He's going to have to settle that business, and so maybe it's a negotiation that's going on. And if that's the case, and he needs to make political space for it, the way things have shaken out with the Saudis, they are in a position to be leaned on to say, just be quiet and let us do whatever we want with Iran.
Well, they want the Americans to do what they're doing. They hate Iran as yes. much as John Bolton does and Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yes, I'm talking about, though, if the U.S. turns around after doing what they're doing and says Iran yeah. came back to the table and now we have a good deal, that the Saudis are in a position where if they don't like the good deal, they still got to shut
I
up.
See. I don't know what really what kind of deal Trump's talking
Me
about.
Me neither. Frankly. No one does. That's the nature of the beast.
I don't know what the deal is. I mean, they want what they've got now, the Americans, I'm saying, which is an embargo on their oil and to crush them and to weaken them and to hurt Iranian citizens under this false idea that they're going to rise up and overthrow the government. And usually that backfires where people actually feel closer to their leader, even if they have differences
with him, right? I don't know that anyone... Put it this way, I don't know that Trump believes that that's what's happening. I'm sure Bolton and some others think that, hey, let's give it a shot and see. But even with that, you have to look through it to an end game. And I'm assuming, of course, that they figure, well, if you walk up to the guy before negotiations, punch him in the face and then say, okay, let's sit down and talk, that the talks will have a different dynamic than if you walk up and buy him a drink. And so that may be what we're witnessing, but the end game being talks. But regardless of what the outcome they expect is, you know, he's saying that, you know, the Saudis are going to be in a position to accept whatever Washington does. And
the end game for the Americans, the Saudis and the Israelis is regime change in Iran. That's the purpose of these sanctions. I don't think it's going to work. They prefer not to go to war, obviously, because of the unforeseen consequence. They will fight back Iran. They made that clear. And that will be a big mess. And Saudi sites could be hit. Israel could be hit. So I don't think they want a war, but they want a regime change. That's what they're trying to do here. That's what this is about. Going back to the table, they would say, okay, we will lift the sanctions if you change the government. That's what I think the American demand
well,
would be.
It's possible. We are going to find out. That's the benefit of these things. You know, we got about a minute left. And there was one other thing that we had promised we would look at. Oh, Assange, real yes. quick, just a quick report on that.
Yeah, well, we learned from Susie Dawson, who's a journalist and an activist very close to Assange and his lawyers, got confirmed that there was an attempt of a break-in on October 29th at the embassy, but Assange had put a fire extinguisher, it seems, on the window, and when it fell, he woke up, and whoever was trying to intrude left. And the fact was, it was never reported to the police, unlike the time when it happened in 2016. In August 2016, there was another attempt to break in, and that was reported to the police. An Ecuadorian government, the previous one, which was friendly to Assange, was angry at the London police for taking 2 hours to respond. But in this case, it looks like security has been lessened, that there is not anybody at the front door, that someone was able to walk in and then press the buzzer. And there's scaffolding put up that's blocking cameras that face the street. So the idea is, it looks like maybe, you know, but you don't know, that the Ecuadorian government is kind of acquiescing in an attempt maybe to abduct Julian Assange.
I hope not.
They want to resolve this thing.
Yeah.
So I hope not.
That's Lenny Moreno. And we're going to have to come back to this next week, Joe.
Sure.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Same here, Don. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.